This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Friday, September 22, 2017. I'm Caleb Brown. Illinois is now the largest blue state to adopt a tax credit scholarship school choice program. At the State Policy Network annual meeting, I spoke with Jason Bedrick of EdChoice about what it means that so many states are adopting tax credit programs for K-12 schooling. Tax credit scholarships are something that are, you know, it's near and dear to your heart, of course. You're from New Hampshire, and New Hampshire now has a tax credit scholarship plan that is growing in popularity. Many states have adopted these. They are very strong in terms of withstanding constitutional scrutiny. And now Illinois, as you noted before we started recording, is the largest blue state to adopt tax credit scholarships. Why did they do it? What was the thing that made it happen?
Right. So there was a battle over the school funding bill between the governor and the legislature. The governor wanted pension reform. The legislature was not in a mood to give it to him, and it seems that they compromised by giving the governor this tax credit scholarship program. So Illinois is now the 18th state in the nation to adopt tax credit scholarships. Like vouchers, they help students attend the school of their choice. The difference is that whereas a voucher is publicly funded, tax credit scholarships are privately funded. So individual or corporate donors make contributions to nonprofit scholarship organizations. In return, they get a tax credit. In Illinois, it's a 75% tax credit. In other states, it ranges from 50% to 100% of their donation. And then the scholarship organization funds low-income kids to attend the school of their choice.
What has been, in states, what has been the distribution of kids in terms of income and race for these kinds of scholarships?
Right, so we don't have a ton of great data from many states, but the largest in the country is Florida. Florida this year just surpassed the 100,000 mark. They've got 105,000 students participating in their program. There are about 250,000 students nationwide. So, I mean, they're just under half. Florida has 70% of their scholarship recipients are Black or Hispanic, and the average family income is only $25,000 for a family of four. It's just a few percentage points over the federal poverty line. So these programs nationwide really are serving the most disadvantaged students.
So 18 states, you said, have these plans. What have been the results that we've seen from some of the longest plans in existence?
So there's actually not been a lot of academic research on tax credit scholarships themselves, in part because what you want is a random assignment trial. So most of the studies of the effects of school choice have been on voucher programs. And consistently, at least until a few years ago, all the random assignment studies found neutral to positive effects. Recently in Louisiana, there was a study that did find a significant negative effect in the first couple years. But this year they released the year three results, and they were statistically insignificant. So after a few years, these students are catching up after, you know, they leave a school. There's some amount of disruption. Also, in Louisiana, the schools had to administer the state test, which they hadn't been used to doing. But it seems that after a few years, they are, even while receiving about half the funding, they are performing on par with their non-school choice peers. There was also a silver standard study in Indiana, which found something very similar, that in the first few couple years there was a negative impact, and then by years three and four it was neutral or even slightly positive. So in the long run, these programs are helping students achieve more academically and also graduate at higher rates, go to college at higher rates. And even Corey DeAngelis, who's now my replacement here at the Cato Institute, now that I've moved over to EdChoice, Corey had a study a few years ago which found lower rates of being arrested or committing crimes, which is very important for a student's future life outcomes.
All right. So with respect to tax credit scholarships, one innovation that we're seeing a lot in states now is education savings accounts. And do those two programs – well, first of all, explain what an education savings account does and how it functions.
Yeah, the difference between a voucher and an education savings account is this. A voucher is a coupon. So if you have a $5,000 voucher, you redeem it at one place at one time, right, at one school. With an ESA, you have a restricted use bank account. So those funds would be deposited into an account that parents could use. In some states, they use a restricted use debit card. And they can then purchase a wide variety of educational products and services. So private school tuition, but also tutoring, textbooks, online courses, educational therapy, and they could save unused funds, roll it over from year to year for later expenses.
Okay, so ESAs allow parents then to combine different kinds of services to design their own sort of educational program for their children.
That's right. And in Arizona, for example, which was the first state to adopt tax credits and the first state a few years ago to adopt ESAs, in Arizona, more than a third of families are using the ESA for private school tuition or these other things. So many of them are doing both. They're using for private school tuition, and then in the afternoon they've got tutoring or whatever. And then just under a third actually are using it for just not even going to a private school at all, just completely customizing their child's education.
All right. So what is the overlap, or is there overlap between these tax credit scholarships that people donate to these groups, and then those groups distribute money to parents for their children's education? What's the overlap there between that, the ESAs, and tax credit scholarships?
Right. So there are six programs right now that six states that have ESA programs that are publicly funded. New Hampshire was the first tax credit scholarship program that said you could use these funds for private school tuition, or you could use these funds for these other things like in the ESA states. This year, New Hampshire revised their law, so they said it's more like an ESA. You can't roll over unused funds from year to year. There's no physical account, but they can use their scholarship funds for tuition or a wide variety of these other services.
And that seems that ESAs, and I know that tax credit scholarships, at least in New Hampshire, have been used for homeschooling as well.
That's right.
But ESAs seem to be more geared toward that type of education.
Yeah, especially many of the programs right now that are ESAs are limited to students with special needs who obviously have a wide variety of educational needs and therapeutic needs outside a traditional classroom. So these families are doing just a very wide variety of things. I mean, things I wouldn't even have thought of, equine therapy, for example, for students with cerebral palsy so that they can, they have a hard time just with balance, never mind going on a playground or something. But once these students are riding horses, it sort of helps rewire their brains so that they can function like more typical students.
All right. So what are we likely to see in the next few years? Supreme Court recently dealt with the Trinity Lutheran case, or as I called it, the playground case, over the ability for churches to receive, participate in a neutral program to provide surface items or use tires for playground equipment. That has pointed to, at the very least, an openness by the Supreme Court to grapple with so many states that have so-called Blaine Amendments.
Yes. Well, first I should mention that we just had a Blaine Amendment case again this year in Georgia. So that was the Gaddy decision, where once again a state Supreme Court, in this case unanimously, ruled that your private dollars do not become the government's money until it actually enters the public treasury. So
that follows on with the Supreme Court precedent as well.
Exactly. So every single state Supreme Court to address this issue has thrown out this challenge. Alabama, Florida, New Hampshire, Arizona, et cetera. There's even some precedent in Illinois as well. So I don't think that there'll be a legal challenge there. And certainly if there is, I don't think that they're going to win. But yes, the voucher programs, whereas tax credits have a 100% rate of being upheld as constitutional, in some cases, vouchers have run up against the Blaine Amendment, which was adopted by most states starting in the late 1800s with the nativist Know-Nothing movement that was explicitly anti-Catholic. And when the public schools in those days were essentially non-denominational Protestant, they taught the Bible, they held prayer in school in a Protestant manner. So Catholics started opening their own schools, asking for tax dollars. And the Protestant elite said, oh, well, we have non-denominational schools. You're welcome to send your kids to our schools and we'll gladly Protestantize them for you. But you can't run your own sectarian schools. That term sectarian is a euphemism for Catholic. Recently, the Supreme Court of Colorado struck down the state's voucher program. Actually, it was the Douglas County voucher program using the Blaine Amendment. The day after the U.S. Supreme Court announced its decision in Trinity Lutheran, which essentially said that you cannot be denied a public benefit that you are otherwise eligible for just because you have a religious affiliation. They vacated that decision. So the U.S. Supreme Court said to the Colorado Supreme Court, that decision is gone. You need to rehear this case in light of our ruling in Trinity Lutheran. That doesn't guarantee that after this eventually goes back up to the U.S. Supreme Court that they are going to rule in favor of the voucher program. But it's certainly an indication that at least some members of the court believe that this case, which you know supposedly was narrowly ruled with regard to tires resurfacing, actually has broader implications, including for school choice. So that you can't have a program that a school would otherwise be eligible, but oh, they have a Catholic affiliation. So even though a parent wants to choose the school, and the parent is the children are the ultimate beneficiaries. You can't go to that school. I mean, that just seems to violate the free exercise clause of the U.S. Constitution.
When you were with us at the Cato Institute and now at EdChoice, we have always gone over sort of recent reform efforts in various states. And we've had multiple, quote unquote, years of school choice in which reform seemed to be doing very well. How was or how has been legislative efforts in 2017?
It's been a big year, not a banner year. So not a year of school choice, or as we had a year of educational choice when everyone was passing education savings accounts. But it was a strong year. So I believe that what we had called the year of educational choice, we had 19 programs, new or expanded. This year, there were 14 states plus Congress reauthorizing the program in Washington, D.C. So 14 states plus D.C. where programs were newly adopted or expanded. I would say of those, the most exciting, we got our sixth ESA program in North Carolina, and in Arizona, they expanded their ESA program, which originally was just for students with special needs, then had expanded to students that were attending schools that had a D or F rating, so low-performing schools, students on Native American reservations, students who were children of active-duty military personnel, and a few other categories. They now expanded it to all students who were either entering kindergarten or who were switching out of a district school, and phasing this program into basically universal over time. So that was a very exciting development. Right now, there is an effort to repeal it. There were a bunch of people that filed petitions. They got enough signatures ostensibly to get it on the ballot in 2018, but there's been a lot of fraud that's been uncovered. So for example, things like one petition or many petitions that were all in the same handwriting, or where the same person signed multiple times, or several petitions in a row where line one was all one handwriting, line two was all the same handwriting, line three was a third person's handwriting, as though they were going through the voter rolls and just passing it around a table. Paid volunteers who didn't check off that they were paid, or who were convicted felons and so were not eligible, lots of things like that. The question is what the courts are going to do with that. If the courts do throw out all of these ballots that have been challenged, then or all these signatures on the petitions that were challenged, then they might not have enough signatures to get on the ballot. But if not, then we'll see what happens next.
Jason Bedrick is Director of Policy for EdChoice. We spoke at the State Policy Network annual meeting in San Antonio. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast at iTunes and Google Play, and follow us on Twitter at Cato Podcast.